Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Miranda Poutney about her contemporary novel, How to Be Somebody Else. Miranda was born in North London, and she read English literature at Oxford University before embarking on a career in advertising, first in London, then in New York. In 2018, she graduated from the Bath Spa Creative Writing MA with distinction. In this episode, we discuss her uncoming-of-age story, how poetry inspired her to be experimental, and why it's important not to rush the writing process. But first, here's Miranda with an excerpt from How to Be Somebody Else.
Tuesday mid-afternoon, Gabe asks her over. Kate's in Marfa prepping a client's exhibition and Gabe comes upstairs and knocks on the door without texting first. This is shocking. She can't decide whether his presence is old-fashioned or hyper-modern, sort of post-social, but it gives her no time to prepare or think, or to buy herself time to prepare or think, so she just says, yeah, she'd like to hang out, and follows him downstairs. They go straight to the bedroom, which is the same as the rest of the apartment. Stark like a waiting room. She doesn't ask him why he's chosen to live in an apartment which is stark like a waiting room, as that would be the same as asking why he's chosen to live with Kate, which would be her next question if she was asking questions instead of just thinking things. The kind of apartment she can imagine him in is much more like Anna's, which makes her relieved they've never met, as it was Anna's robe he'd liked, touching it repeatedly in the bar with the back of his hand, at one point with his cheek, which was strange but felt good. Also Anna's smell, which he'd said was obscene in a good way. You could almost say he'd gone down on Anna. These are the things going through her head while she's undressing in front of him, which are helping her to distract from the fact of undressing in front of him while he undresses in front of her, on the other side of the bed, grinning, just slightly, whenever he looks up. He rolls down a sleeve and asks her what she likes. She has no idea how to answer a question like this, standing in a brightly lit room before they've even touched. She's used to guiding things if she needs to, which she usually does, usually with her hands, but being asked to put it into words like this makes her feel somehow inexperienced. Ideally, the curtains would be closed, but she doesn't want to turn her back to him to do this, so she lies down and watches him instead, head propped up on a pillow, knees drawn up slightly to flatter her thighs. When he pulls off the t-shirt he's been wearing under his button-down, there's a smell like petrol and sweat which makes her wince and flush simultaneously. His arms are muscular, lightly freckled, hair along his broad chest and shoulders. His torso is skinny by comparison, almost concave just below his ribs, and his legs seem skinny too, so that the overall effect is part man-thug, part boy.
Hi Miranda, welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, How to Be Somebody Else.
Thank you for having me. Really glad to be here.
So can you start, Miranda, by telling us what your novel was about?
Yes. How to Be Somebody Else is a novel about the ways we try to build a self and what happens when that self fails to serve us. The novel centres around a character called Dylan, who is a British expat in her late 30s, living in New York City. And I was really interested in the tension between a city whose proposition is infinite possibility at a life stage where it feels like doors are beginning to close, practically, emotionally, biologically, unavoidably. So we drop into Dylan's brain as she sets off a series of I like to think of controlled explosions in her life. Of course, it doesn't work out that way. She walks out of her career, then her apartment, into a house sit and an affair with her married neighbor, who is also not the thing that he seems. And the novel then follows her through the subsequent spring and summer as she tries to achieve what we've been calling an uncoming of age, which I really like as a way of framing it. I feel like the coming of age novel is largely driven by that desire as a young person to know yourself and be known, to gather those badges of identity and belonging that seem to offer a way to move through the world. And this novel pushes in the other direction and asks whether you can shed the selves that you've clung to, and what are the challenges and what's the potential of unknowing yourself at a certain point. And it's also a novel, I think, about the pleasure and pain of yearning and the challenge of accepting. This sounds like a very obvious thing to say, but accepting that everything you choose is instead of something else, which is an incredibly difficult thing to actually get your head around. But yeah.
There's a lot going on in this novel, as you've just described, and I wondered kind of what the starting point was for you, because I'm guessing kind of you, parts of it are, I mean, you lived in New York, so that element is probably something that's from your life. But where did the whole idea come from?
Yeah, it really was that experience of living in New York, not my experiences, but I knew I wanted to write about it, not New York the city so much as New York the emotion, you know, the idea. I mean, it really is a city that is sort of the psychic home of the fantasist. And this is a novel really about fantasy and projection, ideas of the self, ideas of other people, how we build and dismantle these, the big chasm between the reality and the perception. Also, I think the idea of arriving in New York is inescapably symbolic. You know, it's so much connected with the idea of some kind of change or transformation. But what's so clever about that proposition, and New York is a proposition, it's a brand, it's an idea, it's something shaped and fully formed, is that it doesn't require you to articulate what that change is. You know, it can remain wonderfully vague and unrealized, but the statement of intention has been made by arriving. And so, I mean, it's always been quite curious to me that New York has this reputation for very driven people who are chasing down the thing that they want, when at least in my small corner of the city, the thing most people had in common was that they were still trying to articulate what that desire was. And the cost of entry is so high in New York, both financially and emotionally, that you get this kind of raging, untethered ambition that can look a lot like purpose, but quickly dissolves into something much more kind of manic, you know? And the city then becomes this really interesting melting pot of people in a state of sort of, sorry, kind of phrase, like heightened in-betweenness is the best way of putting it, which is why I was interested, not in that sort of wide-eyed moment of arrival, which I think we read about a lot and enjoy in novels and probably would have been more fun to write, but a cast of characters who've been there for a long time, where their relationship with the city is something more thorny and complex, and the yearning is a bit more anemic, and the promise of the city has become more slippery. So yeah, that sort of intersection of place and the symbolism and the life stage for me was the sort of genesis of the book.
So where did you go from there then? You had the city like setting, you knew roughly the kind of themes you wanted to explore, and then you have Dylan. Where did Dylan come from? How did she take shape?
Yeah, I mean, the novel was very much built around her. She was sort of, you know, you got the that sort of moment and that context, and then this person. And on the theme of the sort of the oncoming of age thing, I like the idea of a woman who's smart, accomplished, apparently fully formed, and yet somehow persuasive to everyone but herself. And that's why I enjoyed, obviously, I worked in advertising. There are so many decisions you make when you're like, okay, this very first novelty to stick to things you know, but then you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. You're like, this is the perfect industry for someone who is obsessed with ideas of things and building brands and coherence. And, you know, she's literally in the business of persuasion and can come up with a cohesive proposition for butt cream, but she can't do it for herself. I also very consciously wanted the journey she goes on not to be that sort of face planting, unraveling, messy woman trope. You know, the kind of book cover I mean. Men have existential crises, women unravel, women just lose their shit, you know. And I wanted this to be sort of more cerebral in a way, you know, trying to make dismantling herself an almost intellectual exercise that's both exhausting at times, sometimes uncomfortably cold, and at times, to me at least, very funny, and certainly doomed to fail because, you know, life's not a laboratory. It's full of instinct and emotion and consequence.
I was wondering, on a practical level, you talked about her, should we call it an existential crisis or an coming of age? But did you, when you first had the idea for the novel and of Dylan, have in your head almost like the events of the novel and what would take place? Or did you kind of write to discover what was going to happen?
I very much wrote into it, which is something I might not do next time, as I found it a difficult way to write, in fact. But I knew the sort of tone and the texture of this liminal space that I wanted to create for her. And initially it was really a case of sort of working through scenes and scenarios that might yield this effectively. Then of course, the more choices I made, the more the book took on its own momentum and sort of plot that works, I think, starts to feel in a way inevitable when you're writing it. I'm trying to remember who this quote is from. I think it's Louise Gluck, the poet, who talks about sort of wanting to build environments with her writing and to sort of suggest a meditation as opposed to a stance, which I really like as a driving force rather than something more overtly plot led. I very much felt my way until the sort of the ball started rolling down the hill, so to speak.
Yeah, I think there seems to be a divide of people, either who plan it out or those who kind of write, discover what the story is. And I think there are definite pros and cons to both. Like you said, maybe on your next novel, you might kind of think ahead maybe a bit more, because there's always more editing involved if you think about it as you're going and then you go, oh, that doesn't work. Okay, I've got to rewrite chapter 7 or whatever it is.
Yeah, I would love to plan it out next time. But, you know, as I said, you know, given the sort of the idea for this book was very much rooted in character and place, not in something that was going to happen. I'm not sure it would have been possible with this one, but I would love the experience of, even if it changed a million times, knowing what I was writing towards. And I think one of the things that I really learned the value of is drafting. You know, I think I know we both had been on master's courses for writing. I hadn't done very much before that. It was my sort of pretty much, I made a big leap. And I remember Tessa Hadley saying something really useful about drafting on the course. She was talking about the difference between short stories and novels. And she was like, you know, a novel is this huge piece of engineering, you know, compared to, I think she talked about the short stories being like deliciously irresponsible. It's this sort of wonderful little focused flurry or whatever. But she talked about this piece of engineering. It's like sort of building a bridge out over a river. And just to sort of extend that metaphor, I would describe myself as someone very obsessed with sort of the brickwork, you know, and you need to know where that bridge is going to land and how and why it matters to get to the other side of it, all of that stuff, which I was discovering as I went. But it did mean there was a lot of fancy brickwork that ended up in the scrap heap. And that's time consuming stuff. So I think to get to the whole quickly, and also I'd never worked with an editor before, of course, as none of us have when we're doing our first novel. And I remember being I sort of thought I had this finished thing and it would be a case of, you know, tweaks and which bits of prose and ice. And, you know, the first feedback I got was very much, well, here's where the heat is, you know, this is what feels rich, or at least to me, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, okay, wait. So this is like, we're really talking about the big pieces here, I need to go off and react to that. And I would not have spent quite as much time noodling at a line level before the big piece had been, do you know what I mean? These are all such valuable learnings. I'm sure my strong hope is that I have a much more efficient writing process next time.
We all hope that. We all hope that.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Let's talk a little bit about your MA before. I want to touch on one more thing about the novel. The style of it is really interesting because at parts it's kind of fragmentary and you have a kind of almost stream of consciousness element to it. And I wondered, and also as well, it's very close third person, so we're not in Dylan's head, we're slightly kind of on her shoulder, I suppose. Did you play around with things like that? Did you mess around with style and voice and things before you found your way through, or did that kind of come to you as feeling right from the off?
I did consider first person because of the nature of the book, how much to do with the self it was, but I found that I needed the third person for this sort of analytical distance that Dylan is constantly trying to achieve. Also the way, you know, she's moving through and it's sadly in the moment we find her. I think if she'd lived her life this way for 38 years, you know, she would still be with us. But like her, she's in a moment where she's really trying to observe herself in this situation and understand. I think, yeah, it's a novel about the self, but almost more specifically the project of the self, the one we think we're somehow in charge of designing. So yeah, it was important that it was a close third person, but I needed that little bit of distance in order to be able to sort of execute that analysis as well. And then in terms of the fragmentary style, obviously there are moments that are a bit more fluent and it's not the whole, it's not the whole way through, but it was largely to reflect my sense of the self as really a series of digressions. Do you know what I mean? It is a myth, the idea of this sort of coherent thing, or that, you know, there's some core narrative happening and we occasionally depart from it. It is we're defined by the digressions. The digressions are the sort of not the footnote, they're the meat of the piece. So, you know, along the way, we might have moments of clarity or insight or release, but then we tumble onwards because we're human. And I was trying to find a way of sort of factoring in those tendrils. And it's a delicate balance. So you try not to lose the reader or not sort of keep a thread going. And I think that's why there was quite a bit more plot than I had envisaged to start with, because it's quite unsustainable to, or at least for me, to achieve that level of intensity without other things that are sort of propelling the narrative forwards. Mm. But yeah, I think, you know, we're living in a bit of a sort of soundbite culture that wants us to cohere. And I don't know if you felt this when you're writing your first book, but there's also, I don't know, we have a fetish in fiction for sort of scratching an itch or offering a catharsis that life, in my experience, doesn't necessarily offer. And it's trying to find a place that feels honest amongst that. I mean, so yeah.
Let's go back in time a little bit. I want to kind of find out where this love of writing began. And also, one question I'm always fascinated to ask people is, at what point did you decide to take your writing seriously? Obviously, you did an MA. So I'm guessing that was the point where you were like thinking more seriously about hopefully getting published or writing something for print. Tell us about your kind of early writing journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think really what most writers have in common is their love of reading. And that's something that I had from the get-go. I loved books. I loved studying English. I loved thinking about how things were put together. If anyone had said to me, probably from the age about 12 or 13, if you could be anything in 10 years, I'd have said a writer. And yet it wasn't something I was trying. I think I had a deep fear or lack of confidence in being the origin of something. I'm like, you know, I can reverberate with these things. I can feel very inspired by them. I love being near to creativity. But equally, when I was, you know, I worked in advertising for a very long time. And I wasn't in the creative department. I was in the area where you sell the ideas and you do the pitching. And, you know, I was always the person who celebrated someone else's product. Do you know what I mean? I felt very comfortable in that. And it was probably just I probably didn't put pen to paper until my 30s when I was in New York. And I just take notes and make observations. You know, I had notebooks and notebooks and notebooks. I didn't have an idea for a story or a book, but I just found myself increasingly interested in the dynamics between people. And, you know, I mean, New York is just a dream for that, you know, the characters and the filling in. And actually it was in many ways a bit of an accident that I ended up really properly going for it, because I had to move back to the UK for family reasons, and I found myself in the neighborhood where my parents live in Bath, and I was just like, okay, I can't just be, you know, I need something to do if I'm going to be here sort of supporting you. And the Bath Spa, obviously you have a very well, really good MA. I thought, you know what, why not? Like, I have always wanted to, why not give it a go? And it was quite terrifying because I didn't at the time have something I was working on or whatever. And I was very lucky that came off. I got on. And then, so it really was a big leap. You know, it was sort of from 0 to 100. But it is that wonderful privilege of doing a course like that, if you're lucky enough to be able to afford it and have the time and be in the right place, and of just having that pure focus. And it feels like, I mean, I don't think I believe that writing is necessarily something you can teach, but I think the statement of intention that you make when you say, okay, this year is about writing, and you're in very importantly in a community of people doing the same thing, because you feel slightly insane when you're in another environment, you know, particularly having come from job security and financial security and all of that, and suddenly being like the childhood bedroom version of whatever you're in, you know, that sort of camaraderie and all of that was, extraordinary. And I think that, you know, at the first sort of term and a half, I had no idea what I was doing. I was just sort of feeling my way. I ended up on a poetry module. It was my worst nightmare. ended up being the best thing for my writing, you know, because it is that sort of cross-fertilization between different styles of writing, and the published writers who teach the course will come from different genres, and, you know, and the discipline of poetry, that sort of ruthlessness and form, I think definitely was the thing that gave me the courage to, of course, my novel's not wildly experimental, but some of the things you were talking about that were a little bit more formally jarring or stream of, that a lot of that confidence came from watching what poets do, you know. And the other good thing about this particular course is there's a very strong focus on getting a manuscript to publishing status. So it's not sort of one of, I think there are quite a lot of sort of what I call touristy writing courses, which are like, I want to sort of feel like I'm around writers and feel like, but it's like, this is like, okay, you need to get to at least 40,000 words of something that you want to put into the world. So there's a big focus on actually, you know, behaving like you mean it. And I think my ideas came together probably only towards the final term, which is when you also work on this course one-on-one with a tutor focused entirely on that manuscript. And I won the lottery because I got Tessa Hadley.
You know, amazing.
I know, who is obviously, as we all know,
a legend.
A glorious writer, but she is also the most extraordinary reader. You know, I don't know if you ever watch or been to an event with her or watch interviews or whatever. She has an encyclopedic knowledge of literature and such passion for so many wonderful writers who she's incredibly articulate about. And in many ways, what you, I don't know if you found this, but what you need on a course like that are wonderful readers more than wonderful. It's all very well if you've got wonderful writers, but if they can't teach you, or if they can't respond to your work because it's not like their work, you know. And Tess is the most wonderful reader, and she was incredibly generous with her time and her feedback. She's also the most encouraging person in the world, you know. And also she's in many ways, the reason that this book deal happened for me, because she ended up sending my, slightly sneakily, but thank you to her, sending my manuscript to her, sharing my manuscript with her publisher. I think she'd sat next to my commissioning editor at the Edge Hill Short Story Prize. And the editor just, I think, casually in conversation has said, is there anything you're sort of excited about at the moment? And she mentioned my name and then just sort of left it because I think she thought it was small talk. And then that editor followed up and said, I'd love to have a look.
Wow.
Now, actually, it sort of all happened without my knowing. And so I suddenly get this phone call from Tessa going, I think I've done something a bit.
I've got your book deal. Yeah.
Well, I think she was acting hilariously incredible. Because of her lovely personality. I think she was sort of apologizing. You know, and then sort of maybe a month later, I met with Jonathan Cape, and then I got an agent afterwards. So it was
kind of backwards. Really fascinating. And also, I would say for most people, what a dream way of it happening, because you don't have to go through the pain of querying and then submitting and doing all that side of it. But
so lucky.
Must have made a huge impression on Tessa Hadley, and amazing for doing that. I want to just briefly ask you about your general writing routine, really. I mean, how do you write? How do you get it done? Do you have like a particular routine, or are you kind of one of these scrappy writers that, you know, writes in snatches of time? What's your way of writing?
It's always such a romantic question.
I know, and it never is a romantic answer at all.
The reality is kind of grim, isn't it? I'm sort of in my pajamas and like half watching Grey's Anatomy. No, it's not. Okay. But I think, I mean, if answering this question, I realize how unbelievably privileged I'll sound, because, you know, I had this support early on, I was fully focused on this for a long time. So I wasn't doing a full-time job or child rearing, or I remember Zadie Smith in some context being asked this question, like, oh, how do you, and she was like, I like to write when I'm like, when I have 5 minutes to myself. You know? Whereas, but I, you know, just on the sort of basics, you know, I write in silence, you know, I'm not one of those sort of coffee shop people or whatever. I've just, if there's anything going on around me, I latch onto it immediately. And I think, as I was saying before, the sort of rhythm, the rhythm of the prose is one of my big areas of interest. So I really just need to have nothing interfering with some of the sound of the thing as I'm writing it. For that reason, yeah, I also write at home. I need to start early because my brain function drops about 90% by 4 p.m., which is so interesting because it is such a different part of your brain you're using. When I was working in advertising, which is an insane career, anyone who's considering it, who's listening to this podcast, but I would, you know, it would often frequently be sort of 15-hour days, and you go in and it's crazy from beginning to end, but the amount you achieve is insane. And it's hilarious to me now how little, you know, the relationship between what you put in and what comes out the other end is one of the biggest struggles I've had, having worked in a corporate environment, which is like, well, if I've done a day like that, I have a lot to show for it. Whereas, as you know, with writing, often the more focus you achieve, the more you go backwards, because that's where the way you needed to go or whatever. And I for a long time felt that was a sign that I wasn't good at it, or it was a sign of failure rather than a lot of progress is getting rid of things and, you know, going backwards and sometimes not putting something down on the page if it's not worthwhile, you know. So yeah, I have to start early because my productive day ends a lot earlier than it used to. And then I think that's probably it. I think also not going online before you start. I don't do that most times, but it's so easy to get derailed, especially by things that you can convince yourself are helpful to the writing. Oh, someone's just posted that New Yorker short story. That's, you know, that's educating. And then suddenly you're off to the races, you know, any way of avoiding it. And I have this app called Micromanager, and basically it kills the internet for me in whatever time I set it, but also it sort of blocks certain apps. So, you know, I set these stretches of maybe an hour and a half where there's going to be nothing, and then I'll take 20 minutes off. But I think avoiding those distractions are huge because it takes some, I don't know if you feel this, but, you know, it takes me a good sort of hour to get back into the feeling of the thing I'd been writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
I always think it's like almost like a warm up. It's like an exercise where the first maybe page is not great, and then you get you kind of warm yourself back into it. I know some people are very against reading what you wrote the day before, but I think reading kind of the final couple of paragraphs does help you kind of connect with the voice again and the rhythm and everything. And but when you've had time away from it, or like you say, time on the internet clicking on hashtags or whatever, and you start to lose your mind a little bit. The internet is the best and worst thing for writers. Unfortunately, you know, you need it, but it kills your motivation.
I can't decide if I wish it wasn't there or not, because there are so many ideas there so much insight. But then I think overall I probably wish it wasn't. Do you know what I mean? I think I remember Tessa saying with her ritual, I think she has a couple of, maybe it's Alice Munro and someone else on her desk, and she will rather than read her own stuff back, she'll read a paragraph of someone exquisite, basically.
I always find that's my way in. If I'm feeling stuck, I will head for a book who's and an author who I know, particularly on a line level, that their writing is just completely up my street, and then I will kind of try to absorb that and think, right, okay, hold on to that feeling. And now do it yourself.
It'd feel like.
Yeah.
That's what you need to aspire to. I can't remember, I love listening to other writers talk about these things, but I think it might have been another recent interview I listened to with Zadie Smith, but then she mentioned another few writers who did it when they were younger, particularly typing out the work of other writers that they admire. So I think she typed out all of one Hemingway book or something like that. The feeling, you know, if you think maybe there's some element of muscle memory or something, you know, that somehow via that exercise that you start to absorb some good tics and things like that. Do you know what I mean? I've never done that myself, but I think all of that, I mean, every answer you're looking for, particularly as a debut writer, is in someone else's book. Mm. And I don't, we go around nicking the content. I mean, sometimes all you need is a line break and you've been torturing yourself for 4 days about how do I get them from here to here? And this is, it's like, all right, okay. I just need a space, you know, and it's accumulating those. And again, when I talk about efficiency in the next novel, my hope for efficiency, so many of those lessons you have to learn for the first time. Oh, this is all I need. I just need a stitch here, or I just need a suggestion of time having passed, or whatever it might be. Yeah. But you get those from reading. So it's just like, you just have to read and read and read.
Yeah, definitely. I want to ask you something, which I ask everyone, which is about your experience of being a debut, kind of from the moment you signed your contract. And I know yours is slightly different in the sense that you hadn't finished the book at that point, but what advice would you have for anyone who's about to become a debut? So maybe they've just signed their contract, they've got 18 months to kind of learn the system, learn how it all works, cope with all the emotional highs and lows. What would your advice be to them about how best to kind of cope with it all, enjoy it, survive it, the rest?
God, I wish I had pearls of wisdom. You know, like, I'm a week into my book being in the world, so I'm currently deep in the anxiety weeds. You know, how's it doing? Where's it stopped? What's it feel like? All of that kind of thing. I mean, I think one of the things, and maybe actually this is sort of pre-contract or somewhere around signing contract advice, is, you know, not to rush is, or, and again, I, as I sort of said to you earlier, I took a while to finish mine, but the feeling that I should be rushing or that I should be quicker, or I don't know, there's also, it's funny, I don't know if this is just my self-consciousness playing out or if this is a reality, but I feel like a big sort of PR fetish at the moment is around how quickly someone wrote, so, you know, oh, they're only 12 years old and they wrote it on Saturday or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
As though that somehow reflects on the book in a positive way, or, you know, and I think that does make people, and something that I've noticed, and as I said to you, I didn't do it in the normal fashion. And so I didn't particularly have the chance to wait to share the manuscript because it had already sort of gone out. But it's one of the things I noticed with people I chat to now who are finishing books and this, that, and the other. I say something that I know I'd find really hard to do myself, which is, if you can, leave it for 3 months, come back to it, read it again, draft and draft and draft before you send it to an agent. But, you know, you have all this time on your own and you've put in all of this. There's a sudden sort of sense of urgency at the end of it. Oh, now I want it to be, you know, in the mix. I want the emails to go out. I want to be sort of in that conversation, where the best possible chance you can give yourself, I think, is to become a good writer before all of that happens. Also because there is a certain momentum once it's within the publishing machine, which is, and this is something I've experienced, but you can see in other writers, you know, when you have a success out of the gate, they want the next one pretty quickly, you know, let's strike while the iron's hot, all of that kind of stuff. So take your time to get to a point where you feel proud of what you're writing, I think, before, don't rush the other bit, you know, because also the other bit you can't control, you know, and that's a big, if I have some advice about this point, it is to try and accept that as quickly as possible. The amount of sort of, you know, I remember one of the emails I sent to my agent sort of when I just, in the run up, where I was just like, just feel like I can't see it anyway. I don't even know what I meant by that. It wasn't in the world, but I was just like, you know, and I think I said something like at the beginning of the email, this email is pointless. And at the end of it was like, emotional mayday or something. And she's just wonderful, very experienced person who could just be like, you know, your bit is done. I know it feels uncomfortable, this, that, the other, but, the, you know, it's just accepting that you can't control the next bit. Some people will like it, some people won't. That, you know, it will in time hopefully find its readers, but that bit isn't your problem, you know. Yeah. And trying to remember that the choices you made sense for the book and all of that kind of stuff, I think, and not comparing yourself to other writers, because it will always feel like someone else is getting more attention or buzz or whatever. And, you know, everything is contingent. there is, you know, not to take it personally, I think, probably.
Miranda, finally, can you give us a little tease about what you might be working on next?
I actually can't. I can only tell you that I'm writing into a couple of ideas at the moment that are jostling. I think one of them, I'm feeling quite good about one of them. I'm hoping one of them will stick, but I'm waiting. You know that moment I told you about when the ball starts rolling down the hill? I'm waiting for that. But I, and actually, sorry, this is just to answer one of your other questions as well. A great idea is to be well into that when your book comes out. I wasn't. And it just gives you lots of room to obsess. You know, if you're focused on something else that you're making, you get excited about the next thing. So it's in progress, but not imminent.
We all wish that we could have, well, I certainly wish I could have had the second book on the go as my first one was going out into the world, but that wasn't the case. And not for you either, but Miranda, but I know you're working hard on ideas for the next one. So I'm wishing you luck with that. And also how to be somebody else. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much.
That was Miranda Pountney talking about her contemporary novel, How to Be Somebody Else, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.